Our study is going to be from the Gospel of John, so I'd encourage you to take out a New Testament, turn to that book of the New Testament. From this Gospel this morning, we talked about what Jesus did to create belief among men that He had come from God, that He was, in all appearances, as a human being, but in His deepest nature, He was more than a human being. And we read a number of passages in John's Gospel where reference was made to Jesus being the one that God had sent. We talked about the fact that that truth is established in two ways in the life of Jesus, in His teaching and in His works. And so we examined the Gospel from the standpoint of those who saw His works. Some believed on that basis and many others did not. And we said that just simply seeing a miracle would represent belief on the lower rung of the ladder, as it were. And our deeper and true belief in Jesus is really going to come from listening to Him and considering what He's saying and how He defined Himself and how He defined mankind and how He expressed God and the nature and the character of God in His life. We said that the Gospel of John sometimes is called the Gospel of Belief, and we kind of subtitled it. It's also the Gospel of Unbelief, because unbelief is mentioned so often in the Gospel. Tonight we're going to go in a little bit of a different direction. And I would like to suggest we could also call the Gospel of John the Gospel of Controversy. And what I would like to do, and I hope this won't be too tedious, hang in there with me and let's go through this, but we're just going to do a quick survey of the whole Gospel, pretty much. And I want to point out with you, episode after episode, through the Gospel of John, as to how Jesus, in standing up for the truth of His nature and the truth about God who had sent Him, how that message and that courage and that conviction that He had so often was transformed into opposition and into controversy, argumentation, and ultimately suffering and death on His part. So, limber up your fingers here. Let's go to John chapter 2. And it's not my nature, but I'll try to be brief as we go through these things point by point. Chapter 2, verses 14 through 18, Jesus Himself kind of gets the ball rolling in regard to controversy. He goes to the very heart of Judaism and all of its traditionalism and its corruption. And we find in John 2 that Jesus goes into the temple and physically drives out the people who had corrupted that house of prayer and turned it into a house of merchandise. He found in the temple, verse 14, those who sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers doing business. When He had made a whip of cords, He drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And He said to those who sold doves, "Take these things away. Do not make My Father's house a house of merchandise." Then His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for Your house has eaten Me up." And not unsurprisingly, the Jews took great offense at that. Jesus had done violence to them. He had done it in the name of godliness. He had done it with the intent of defending the honor of God, the temple of God. But nonetheless, we cannot construe what Jesus does here as a matter of gentleness. He is standing firm for what is right and physically demonstrating that the temple had been corrupted, and He's trying to restore it to its purity. And this is not all. He will do this same thing again later in His life. But controversy erupts from this, and not surprisingly again. And so a conversation ensues there between Jesus and the Jewish leaders as to what gave you the right to do these actions. Then in chapter 3, we talked about Nicodemus this morning. One of the Jewish rulers themselves comes to Jesus by night and wants a further interview with Him. And so in verses 9 through 12, as this conversation unfolds, and Jesus is trying to show to Nicodemus that he's on the wrong track. There are spiritual realities that Nicodemus needs to be understanding, but even as a teacher of Israel, they have escaped him. So chapter 3 and verse 9, Nicodemus answered and said to Him, "How can these things be?" Jesus is referring to the need to be born again. Jesus answered and said in verse 10, "Are you the teacher of Israel and you do not know these things? Most assuredly, I say to you, we speak what we know and testify what we have seen, and you do not receive our witness. If I have told you earthly things and you do not believe, how will you believe if I tell you heavenly things?" I don't know how you read that, but I read frustration on Jesus' part there. Because think about it. As we talked about this morning, Jesus claims to be the one who has come from God. And in various places throughout the Gospel of John, he claims pre-existence and equality with the Father. So put yourself in Jesus' shoes. He knows all of this heavenly reality. He knows everything about this divine realm that we cannot see. And he comes into this very limited form of existence, this earthly temporal form, takes on the form of a man, and has so much to say to people about spiritual realities, and he knows that they can't handle it. And so he reduces himself to either telling parables or telling using similes, metaphors, trying to get points across to people like Nicodemus about being born again. Nicodemus says, "I don't quite get that." And Jesus says, "I know you don't get it. You're the teacher of Israel, so you claim. And I can't even talk to you using an earthly illustration about grand heavenly truth." And Jesus said, "There's so much more I could tell you, but you can't take this." And so again, we don't have just a nice, quiet conversation. We've got stress. Because Nicodemus cannot receive spiritual things. Then in chapter 4, verses 19 and 20, we talked about Jesus talking to the Samaritan woman in Sychar, and then how the whole town of Sychar comes to believe in Jesus because not of his work so much, but his words. He teaches them over a couple of days and reveals truth to them from God's will, and as a whole, they accepted it. But even that was not without difficulty. Go back to verses 19 and 20. When Jesus reveals something about the private details of this woman's life, the woman says in verse 19, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet." Well, that's a correct perception on her part. It doesn't go far enough, but certainly Jesus is a prophet. But look what she does next. Rather than say, "Please tell me great spiritual heavenly truths," she starts an argument. "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." And so Jesus, first of all, has to set her attitude straight, and he does that rather directly. "You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. Salvation is from the Jews, not the Samaritans." And then he goes on and teaches her something about true worship that's going to come in the New Covenant, worship in spirit and truth. But you see how quickly the woman wants to take up controversy with Jesus and see what he thinks about the raging controversy of the day. Chapter 5, verses 16 through 18. Jesus heals a lame man on the Sabbath day, which was one of the primary things that Jesus did, not just in this episode, but about six times. Jesus does what the Jews consider to be a violation of the Sabbath day. And I'm telling you what, Jesus pokes his finger in their eye. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he does it anyway. Not out of spite, but he's trying to open their minds. He's trying to break through that crusty thinking, as it were. And so he will do this on occasion just to provoke them. Not again to anger, but to thought. But in verses 16 and following of John 5, "For this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath." Now, what do we say this morning about miracles? If you're not disposed to understanding and appreciating the divine origin of an act, a miracle won't convince you. These people have seen a miracle and they're upset that it had been done on the wrong day. Never thought to question whether their conception of the Sabbath day was correct or not, but they're upset in seeing a miracle that occurs on the wrong day. That's how carnal thinking approaches even a miracle. But Jesus answered them in verse 17, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." True statement. I'm in fellowship with the Father in what I say and what I do. "Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God." Jesus speaks the truth, but it incites them to murderous anger. And the reason is, for one, down in verse 38, you do not have His Word abiding in you, because whom He sent, you do not believe. That is a powerful indictment of these people. And of us today, if it's true of us. You do not have His Word abiding in you, because whom He sent, you do not believe. Down to verse 42, but I know you, that you do not have the love of God in you. Now you talk about fighting words. Those were fighting words. Jesus took this to these people. And sometimes it was very blunt and very direct. You do not have the love of God abiding in you, and you do not have the Word of God abiding in you, and that's why you can't see Me for what I am. In John chapter 6, we said this morning we would come back to this passage tonight. We have a multitude of people in John 6 who've seen a miracle, the feeding of the 5,000, the multitudes that were given food with an insufficient amount to start with, a miracle of prosperity. And yet, they continue to say to Jesus, well, what sign are you going to do? Show us something else. Titillate us, excite us. Work another magic trick for us. And so what we see in John 6 is a turning point in the life of Jesus. We see that until this time, He's surrounded by great multitudes of people who would be His followers, people who would be interested in Him and acknowledging Him on some level. And we said this morning that belief exists on a number of different levels and has different shades to it. These people are following Jesus, but really, ultimately, for carnal reasons. And Jesus points that out to them. But He teaches them some spiritual truths. Think back to Nicodemus. If you can't swallow what I'm saying to you now with an earthly illustration, what would you do if I revealed to you heavenly truths? Jesus uses an earthly illustration here about eating His flesh and drinking His blood. They don't get it, and they're offended by that. Well, can't you hear them? I can't believe He said that. I just can't believe that a preacher would get up and talk like that. Eat My flesh and drink My blood. What a grotesque illustration. You don't think people would say that, do you, today? But they did. And we find in verse 41... the Jews murmured against Him because He said, I am the bread which came down from heaven. In verse 52, the Jews therefore quarreled among themselves, saying, how can this man give us His flesh to eat? In verse 60, they complained about His teaching. Therefore, many of His disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a hard saying, and who can understand it? You know what they said? He's over my head. That's just a little bit too complicated for me. Verses 61 and following, Jesus knew in Himself that His disciples murmured about this, and He said to them, does this offend you? What then if you should see the Son of Man ascend where He was before? You're offended because I said I came down from God? What would you do if you saw Me go up to Him? It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words that I speak to you are spirit, and they are life. But verse 64, there are some of you who do not believe. Remember, the Gospel of John is not just the gospel of belief, it's the gospel of unbelief. And many of the times, as I mentioned before, that the term belief or some form of that term is used in John, oftentimes the word not is in front of it. They did not believe. And so we have a chronicle here of people who met Jesus and saw Him and heard Him and believed, and then many did not. The turning point here is in verse 66. From that time, many of His disciples went back and walked with Him no more. Well, I'm going to tell you, that wasn't a shock to Jesus, and it wasn't because He misspoke. He knew exactly what He was doing. And what He was doing was dividing followers into those who were true followers and those who were not. And so again, we have division and controversy. I guess I could show you this since I worked on it. Let me get caught up here. Maybe that'll help keep up with what we're talking about, because I'm throwing a lot at you, I know. John chapter 7, beginning of the chapter, Jesus' own brothers challenge him. And in verse 5, it just simply says, even his brothers did not believe. You know, Jesus had unbelief from all quarters, from the Jewish hierarchy to the very masses of people who were following him, even into his family. Now, as we study along, this is not just, you know, an intellectual examination here. Put yourself in Jesus' shoes. You've come to save the world. You've come to reveal the true nature of the divine to men. You've ultimately come to sacrifice yourself so that something in what you say or do, or even the ultimate act of sacrifice, might reach into the heart of a human being and help them be saved. This is what you've come to do. And even your own brothers don't believe in you. Later in John chapter 7, Jesus attends a feast in Jerusalem. And this turns into a citywide buzz, if you will, about the great prophet we've heard so much about in town. He's actually here. You know, it's the same guy that just a while back was here and trashed the temple. People have been hearing about Jesus. They've been hearing about his exploits and his miracles. And he's an object of great curiosity. And so the city of Jerusalem is abuzz. And so, looking at verse 12, there was much murmuring among the people concerning him. Some said he's good. Others said no. On the contrary, he deceives the people. However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Jewish leadership's trying to put a lid on this thing, clamping down and threatening people with rejection and expulsion. And so people are afraid to talk openly, but that doesn't stop them from talking. And the Jews marvel in verse 15, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? And so they challenge Jesus on his moral goodness. Is he good? Some said yes, some said no. All he ever did was good. But some said, oh, no, he's not good. Well, how does he know anything anyway? Did he go to Harvard? Did he go to Yale? Does he have a degree from one of our schools, Hillel or Shimei? No. Verse 20, it breaks open into wild accusation. The people answered and said, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? When Jesus acknowledged that the fact that they were. Look at what happens when Jesus speaks the truth to people. It often doesn't go over very well. And here he acknowledges that their murderous intent, and their response is, you are possessed. The devil has taken hold of you. Now let me ask you a question. Based on what else we read about demon possession in the New Testament, is Jesus acting like a demon-possessed man? That's how far people are willing to go in making false accusations about someone who's speaking the truth to them. You have got to be possessed. In verse 32, we read this morning about an attempted arrest. And what you begin reading here through the Gospel of John, not only is like the development of the belief and faith of the apostles along the way when they see Jesus do various works and miracles, but what you also see is that faith in him grows, opposition to him grows. And so you can trace the opposition of the Jewish leadership step by step by step, and now it's an open attempt to arrest him. And we talked this morning about the guards coming back empty-handed, saying, never a man spoke like this. But in verse 43, it says there was a division among the people because of him. In verse 48, as the Pharisees are responding to these law enforcement officials, if you will, who come back empty-handed, said, have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him? Verse 48, as if they were the standard. They were the litmus test. None of us have believed in him. But who are you to believe in him? In chapter 8, verses 1 through 12, Jesus next is challenged with a public moral test. The woman taken in adultery. Jesus was not the one to adjudicate this. He's not the one to pass judgment. They had a court for that, and they had legal proceedings for this. And in fact, if the thing had been the way it was said to be, and witnesses could be produced, which should have been the procedure followed. Jesus really would have had nothing to say or do with this matter. But nonetheless, they're trying to trip him up. They're trying to get him to expose himself publicly and taking a moral stand that would be perhaps unpopular, and they could speak against him. But this is sort of reminiscent to me of Solomon's cut the baby in half. You know, he kind of called their bluff. Oh, well, here's this one baby and two mothers. Well, cut it in half, give each of them half the baby. Well, that exposed who the true mother was and who the false mother was. And what does Jesus do? Well, if she's in adultery, take up stones and stone her. Go ahead. I know how he phrases this. You who are without sin, and that's often misunderstood, as if we shouldn't pass judgment on someone in this situation. But I think what Jesus basically is saying is, if this is a clear-cut, legitimate case, deal with it. But if you have brought her with false pretenses, then you pick up the first stone and throw it at her. Jesus calls their bluff. And they all leave, interestingly, it says, from the oldest to the youngest. I think that's significant. But controversy. What is Jesus doing? Speaking the truth. What's he doing? Revealing the Father? Talking about the nature of divine things? And what's the response he's getting? Increased opposition. To the point now that his life is coming more openly in jeopardy. In fact, if you look down in verses 13 and following, there's open conflict now that breaks out. Not a clandestine attempt to go out and arrest him. But look at the conversation here. Look at verse 13. The Pharisees therefore said to him, "You bear witness of yourself. Your witness is not true." What's Jesus been doing? Teaching the will, the words of the Father. What's he been doing? Backing it up with miraculous signs. And what's the claim of the Pharisees? You're a liar. You're not teaching things that are true. And you're certainly not claiming things that are true about yourself. Go down to verse 33. This is where Jesus begins talking to them about true liberty. And again, like Nicodemus, he doesn't understand. The people here don't understand. Jesus is talking about spiritual freedom and spiritual liberty, but either the Jews aren't getting that point, or they simply will not acknowledge the fact that they do have spiritual need. They said to him, "We're Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" I don't think they're unaware that the Romans are occupying Jerusalem. I don't think they're denying that. I think what they're saying is, we don't have any spiritual need. Abraham is our father. We're descendants of Abraham. And you're trying to insinuate that we're separated from God. That's not true. I think that's really what they're saying. In verses 48 and following, we have a racial slur now added to the accusation of being demon-possessed. Then the Jews answered and said to him, "Did we not say rightly that you are a Samaritan?" Now we're just plain old name-calling. "You're a Samaritan." That's a racial slur to them. "And you have a demon on top of that." Jesus answered and said, "I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. Thus, you dishonor my Father," is what he's trying to get them to see. Why the resistance? Why the pushing back? Why the controversy when all Jesus is trying to do is reveal the truth of heaven? Well, the reason why is in verses 43 and 44. "Why do you not understand my speech? Because you're not able to listen to my word. You are of your father, the devil. Abraham isn't your father, and God isn't your father. You are of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. But because I tell the truth, you do not believe me." This is why there's controversy. This is why Jesus is butting heads chapter after chapter after chapter of the book of John. Because we're coming at this from two different points of view. You are carnal and doing the work of your father, and I'm doing the work of my father, but I am light and you are darkness. I am truth and you are liars. I'm here for life and you stand for death. That's why you reject me and you want to kill me. Well, in John chapter 9, Jesus heals the blind man. Another, not just a work done, but a benevolent work done. John chapter 9 and verse 24, here's the passing of sentence on Jesus. So again, they called the man who was blind and said to him, "Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner." Well, their mind's made up. They've already made up their mind about the nature of Jesus, and what they've made up their mind is that he is a sinner. He violates the Sabbath. He blasphemes the name of God. He's offering people forgiveness of sins. He's a sinner. And bless his heart, all the blind man really can say to that is, "You know what? I know I was blind, and now I know I can see. You make up your own mind." But he was getting it, and they were not. But look at verse 34. The controversy over Jesus now begins to expand to his disciples, to those who believe in him. The blind man responds to them in a way that they're offended. It says in verse 33, "If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered and said to him, "You are completely born in sins, and you're teaching us," and they cast him out. There's the excommunication they've been threatening on the people of Judea if they acknowledge Jesus. Now they're practicing it against this man who's been healed by the Lord. And so they're not content. Remember, we talked about Lazarus this morning. When Lazarus was raised from the dead, they weren't content just to go after Jesus. Now we've got to get rid of Lazarus. It's like putting out a grease fire, you know? You put water on it and it starts spreading everywhere. And that's what they've got on their hands. The truth is beginning to spread. And they can't put out the fire. Well, John chapter... Oh, I forgot the blind man here. John 9, John 10. I'm just going to pick up the pace here a little bit. There's the discussion of the true shepherd and the sheep. Again, Jesus is, in verses 19 and 20, said to have a demon and now to be insane. So he's a Samaritan and he's got a demon and he's insane. And he's speaking the words, as Paul said, the words of truth and reason. The Feast of Dedication in John chapter 10. The challenge is made to Jesus, "If you are the Messiah, tell us plainly." And Jesus has been telling them plainly and been demonstrating exactly who he is. And the response is this in verse 31 of John 10, the Jews took up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered and said, "Many good works I have shown you from my Father. For which of those works do you stone me?" And the Jews answered and said, "For a good work we do not stone you, but for blasphemy, because you, being a man, make yourself God." Jesus came to do the will of God, to teach his words, to do his works, to reconcile sinners to mankind. And what we find is mankind as a whole does not want that reconciliation. Well, John chapter 11 is the story of Lazarus. And we talked about Jesus' prayer before he raises Lazarus from the dead. What I want to look at tonight with you is verse 48. We actually, back up to 45. We noticed 45 this morning that when Jesus works these works, some people are believing in him. Verse 46, "Some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, 'What shall we do? For this man works many signs.'" Watch verse 48. This is revealing. "If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." Do you see what's in verse 48? The very thing God is trying to do is the very thing the Jews don't want done. Jesus came to save. He came to create belief. And now the Jews are afraid everybody's going to believe in him. That's what Jesus came to do. "I'm from God, believe in me, and here's the evidence, and here's the words, here's the character, and here's the nature. Look at it." And the Jews are going, "We don't want everybody to believe in him. We don't want anybody to believe in him." But they're so afraid of this belief. And again, we had a major turning point in John 6. We've got another major turning point in John 11. Because from the time Lazarus is raised from the dead, the Jews are intent on killing Jesus. They simply cannot let this stand. This is a great miracle done in their very midst, as Jesus had done already. But this one takes the cake. Healing a blind man or healing a lame man, well, that's one thing. But raising somebody from the dead? No, we can't have that. This has crossed the threshold. And we must get rid of him. Well, in John chapter 12, Jesus, in the last week of his life, is having a meal with his disciples and friends. Here, Jesus is not with the unbelieving Jews, thus experiencing what might be expected controversy, but here he is closed in a private with his friends, and guess what? There's controversy even here. In verses 5 through 8 of John 12, Mary anoints Jesus and immediately comes under fire for wasting the ointment. Boy, howdy. Kind of sounds like some churches, doesn't it? Finding something, seemingly, to fuss about. Here's a woman like Jesus doing good. And of course, Judas has his ulterior motives because he's stealing from the money bag. And you know, that's where criticism often comes from, is other motives that people have. Sometimes we tell on ourselves when we criticize and when we murmur and complain. We're really revealing perhaps what's in our heart. And that's what Judas is doing. He's revealing his own greed and avarice. But he's trying to pretend like Mary's doing something wrong in the process. And Jesus says, leave her alone. She's anointing me for burial. But again, controversy, even when Jesus is with his closest associates. John 13, this is the Passover meal then, as Jesus will shortly be taken into custody. What's going on during the meal in John 13? The disciples are arguing. There's controversy again. Which one of them is the greatest? Which leads Jesus in John 13 to get up from the table and don the towel and wash the disciples' feet? As we trace this succession of episodes and we see this controversy that dogged Jesus all of the time, now we're at the last meal with his disciples, and Jesus knows what's coming. Don't you get a sense of heaviness of heart here? Of what Jesus must have been feeling? I mean, I won't ask for a show of hands, but if I did, how many of us like controversy? How many of us like to argue? How many of us like being at odds with other people? How many of us like discord? Well, some people on some level seem to like it. There certainly seems to be a lot of it. But most of us would say, no, we don't desire that. We don't want that. We don't want to seek that out. We don't want to be the cause of it. And yet it still seems to exist. And so here's Jesus now with his closest associates, those that have been the closest to him, the most intimate with him, have seen his works and heard his teaching, and they're fussing about which one of them is the greatest. How heavy Jesus' heart must have been when he can't even escape controversy in private with his own disciples. And then, we don't even have the time to go here, the trial. False witnesses, pious priests, when Jesus acknowledges that he's the king. Oh, horrors! Tearing their robes. This is terrible, he's blasphemed. And in their piety, themselves being the blasphemers. Because God has been demonstrated to them in human form, and they cannot, will not see it. Jesus' divinity is challenged. Peter denies him. The clamor for Barabbas, a common criminal, a murderer, instead of Jesus to be released. Ridicule from the soldiers. The crown of thorns, putting the rod in his hand. Herod, all Herod wants to do is see a magic trick. Passers-by reviling him as he hangs on the cross, his life blood dripping out of his body and down the cross to the ground, providing redemption for men and being made fun of as it's happening. Okay, all of this for what? Jesus was a lightning rod, not because he enjoyed drama, not because he invited it because of a quick temper, not because of his unwise speech. Ooh, I shouldn't have said that. That really made him mad. Not because he taught new things just to be different, not because he wanted publicity. Jesus was in the midst of controversy from start to finish because he stood for the truth. He stood for the truth of his own nature and would not, could not deny himself. He stood for the truth of God's revelation, putting the Old Testament in its proper context. But then telling people a new order is coming as well. A higher spiritual order. He told the truth of God's mission that He came to fulfill. I did not come to do my will, but the will of the Father who sent me. And I will not be untrue to that mission, no matter what you say. Look at how He sums it up in John 18 when He's before Pilate. John 18 and verse 37. Pilate said to Him then, "Are you a king?" And Jesus answered and said, "You rightly say that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And the contrast to that is also so. Everyone who is not of the truth will not hear my voice. And so Jesus did not give in, as the natural tendency for us might be, under such withering controversy and rejection from those around us in the world, or even sometimes among us as brethren. The tendency that we might have when facing this kind of opposition, this kind of stress, is to give in, to soften the message, to blunt the truth, to be a little more likable, to not be so offensive in what we say. And I'm not advocating being offensive. What I am advocating is not abandoning or softening or compromising the truth, because at times it leads to controversy. Let me share with you just part of an article I did read in the paper today, and it has to do with the religious debate that took place, I think, at Emory, or I know one of the professors from Emory was involved in it, between him and an atheist. And so there's been point, counterpoint in the paper, letters to the editor about this. But one man wrote in today, and here's part of his solution for religious controversy. "Let us seek to understand the deeper archetypal meaning behind our religion's beliefs and practices. In so doing, we will understand the particular beauty and value of a specific religious belief and practice, while simultaneously discovering that there are many paths that lead to an experience of the holy. This will eliminate the need to go to war and defend one's religious beliefs and way of life." Listen, I'm not advocating we go to war. I'm not advocating we plant roadside bombs and try to bomb the other side into submission. But David led "Stand Up for Jesus" is a militant song. We were singing a militant song just a few minutes ago. And there is a militancy that comes with defending the truth. No, it's not carnal militancy. Paul points that out in 2 Corinthians 10. Our weapons are not carnal weapons. We're not trying to physically pound people into submission. But what is called for from the disciples of the Lord in this struggle between light and darkness and good and evil is courage and the willingness to stand up for what is right, and to resist the temptation to knock the edges off the truth because we're afraid of who it might offend. I want to share it with you, and this may be a little difficult here. The type is small to get it all on here. But it's an observation that I read recently that I thought was disturbing. And let me just explain. This is an observation that was made by a religious professor concerning churches of Christ from an institutional point of view. Those churches that would be, and I'll just use the terminologies that most of us would understand, they would be pro-human institutions. And so this person is writing about what they see as trends among institutional churches. So just keep that in mind as we read. And if you can read that. What the professor is saying is this. Actually, I think it was a female writing. "Absorption into the mainstream of the American religious life can also be seen in the effort to present a message which is softer, more polished, and much more positive, according to Pulley," that's the professor that did the studies. "After quoting a denominational historian on the softening and polishing of the more hardline and barbed elements of the Orthodox Protestant worldview," Pulley observes, "that this civilizing of the evangelical doctrinal message also would seem to be true of churches of Christ. Theirs is a kinder, gentler message, Instead of trying to evangelize in order to free others from their fear of the fires of hell, evangelistic efforts seem to be framed much more positively. In keeping with recent history among mainstream bodies, churches of Christ tend to present an upbeat and positive image about their lives, a characteristic that Peter Berger has referred to as the Protestant smile. Good to see you, brother. How you doing, brother? Everything's fine, brother. And it's about as fakey as that. An unwillingness to acknowledge we're in a fight. We're in a battle, and we're not going to nice people into the kingdom. And we're not going to defend the truth always by seeking the path of least resistance. That's why I went through this accounting of Jesus' life in the Gospel of John to see what was true of His life. And He said everything right and did everything right. And please do not misunderstand, I am not advocating being ill of spirit, speaking ugly to people. I am advocating standing up for the truth and not compromising it. And what this writer is saying, what this religious professor is saying is, she sees documentation and evidence of that in more institutional groups. Pulley points out that evangelical denominations and many churches of Christ have accommodated to cultural pluralism in regard to their exclusive doctrinal truth claims. There is less and less appeal to absolute scriptural truth, i.e., less appeal to book, chapter, and verse, and more appeal to subjects which make people feel happier, healthier, and more at peace with themselves. If the message of old that we are the one true church, consequently the only ones going to heaven, which has been leveled against churches of Christ for a long time, if that message is still spoken in the city church, it's only in whispers. The new emphasis is toward feeling good about one's private life and relationships, mental health, counseling, family life, and psychology. This trend is causing church members to read more literature from other religious groups. Another indication that the walls of exclusivism between the true Church of Christ versus all others are crumbling. The shift away from hardline or exclusive truth claims are gradually replaced by subjective and mystical truth claims. The restoration principle must be reinterpreted in a more open and pluralistic way as church members search for security while also searching for a new theological direction, a new identity, a new hermeneutic, a new mission, and a new worship. For such church members sitting in a worship service and listening to a somewhat lengthy sermon based on infallible doctrine and exclusive truth seems more and more irrelevant to their lives in a postmodern world, Pulley observed. What that observation is saying is people are putting into practice what this guy in the paper wrote today. And they're putting it into practice in congregations who identify themselves as a Church of Christ. If what I'm saying tonight is Greek to you, I would suggest you need to do some research and read a little bit more. Because these trends started in the more modern sense, at least as far back as 1988. Because I attended a meeting between institutional brethren and conservative brethren, non-institutional brethren, in Nashville in 1988, almost 20 years ago, where these very things were discussed. And the idea of a new hermeneutic was being pushed almost 20 years ago. Well, a lot of that push was successful, and book, chapter, and verse went out the window in a new hermeneutic. The feel-good way of approaching the gospel was introduced. And the result is this professor is writing, the evidence is clear when examining churches of Christ with an institutional bent. In other words, to boil all that down, their preaching is no different than a lot of denominational preaching anymore. Jesus knew that the devil would not release his grip on the souls of men without a fight. And Jesus was willing to fight that fight. And what is our theme for this year? Serving. Serving one another. Brethren, I'm telling you, Jesus was the ultimate servant. When he came to fight against the wiles and the tactics of the devil, when Satan had his claws sunk deeply into the hearts and souls of men, and Jesus came with the truth of who he was and who God was and what the truth was that God wanted him to proclaim, thanks be to God he was not a coward. That he stood up for the truth when everything that he claimed and everything that he was and everything he stood for was laid on the line. Yeah, you're a demon. You've got a demon. You're a Samaritan. You're mad. You're out of your mind. You're a blasphemer. Jesus held to the truth. And my exhortation tonight, brethren, is that we do the same thing. And if we don't, we're not going to be the servants of one another that God wants us to be. We're not going to honor the stewardship of service that God has given to us. It is so imperative we do not sell out the truth because we're afraid of offending somebody. And we do not openly stand up and say what is right because we're afraid we're going to drive somebody away. The gospel is designed to separate. It is designed to identify, and that's what Jesus did in his teaching and in his works. He identified who were the true sheep and who were following the false shepherds. And so Paul says in Acts 14 and verse 22, we, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. We don't get a free pass. We sing a song along that line. I probably can't think of it right offhand, but, you know, Jesus goes through all this and we have a bed of ease, as it were. No. We have the same fight to fight. From prison, Paul writes to Timothy, yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. But I'll tell you what really trumps all of the tendency around us to soften the truth and compromise the truth and appeal to and accommodate men when they're critical and whatnot. You know what underlies all of that? It's a love for the souls of men that will enable us to stand up to controversy and difficulty like Jesus did so that we can perhaps save somebody. If we sell out on this issue of softening the truth, as even some of our own brethren have done, we're selling out on the souls of men. We may think we're saving ourselves some hardship, but what we're doing is we're selling our fellow mankind down the river. Because if we don't stand for the truth, we who claim to see it in a clearer light than most, if we don't stand for the truth, who, pray tell, is going to? Well, I'll tell you, somebody will. Somebody will. Somebody will have enough of this social psychobabble stuff and go back to the Bible like we have claimed to do in our history. Go back to the Bible. Go back to the Bible. Teach the truth. Well, let's practice our own preaching. We need to teach the truth and be bold about it and loving, speaking the truth in love, but not cowardly and not backing away and not trying to soft pedal the truth so as to hopefully convert one or two along the way. God's got a job for the gospel to do. Let's let it do its job. And we can do that by being bold and proclaiming the truth and being unashamed of that. I'm going to sing a song to encourage you to obey the truth if you have not done so. Whatever there may be in your life that is not in harmony with the will of God, it's not in keeping with what you know God is expecting of you. If you've not become a Christian, if you haven't fallen away, or just you're simply not as fervent in your faith as you need to be. And I hope we've challenged you today with that very issue. How fervent and how deep and strong is your faith? If it's something that we can help you with, we're happy to do it. If it's something you need to go home and pray in your closet about, we encourage you to do that as well. But as we're standing and singing, if we can help you, would you come?